you want to be wealthy,
yeah,
earning a salary is not how you become wealthy.
Right.
Ownership is how you become wealthy.
Right.
When you walk into a situation, always allow yourself to just like be available to what can happen. You have to honestly be motivated by more than just the money. Investing and finance is a long game.
Yeah.
Right? If you want to be able to monetize, you have to play the long game.
Welcome back to Financially Incorrect. I am your host, Barack. And remember, this is a podcast sponsored by FX Spesa. If you'd like to learn about trading, if you'd like to open a live account or a demo account, please check out all the links in the description box. They do everything trading. They have physical classes in Nakuru, Eldoret, Thika, Kitengela, and Kampala. So please be sure to check any of those out. Open the links in the description box. You can, I guess, learn, you can understand. And yeah, remember, FX Spesa, the reason we're able to bring you this fantastic content. So yeah, do check them out if you feel so inclined. Today, I have a really interesting episode. We've been chatting like for the last 25 minutes before we started, and I cannot wait to get into this because there's so many things I want to understand. But first, I have to get his name right. And I'm hoping that I have it. It's Quinwi Tawa, who is the CEO and founder of Baki Beauty, but has a history of literally working in everything that's money. He's been telling me about figures that I have not seen in my life. So I'm really, really interested to get into this and for you guys to understand. I think when we're talking, for his first like 24 years, lived in like eight different countries. So a really, really interesting story. Welcome to Financially Incorrect.
Thank you. Super, super happy to be here.
Yeah.
I would say that it is God's blessing that I'm here because funny enough, I remember when Franklin mentioned getting on this podcast with you. Initially, I was reluctant.
If I'm being honest. Oh, he didn't tell
not
us.
Not because of you. Yeah. But because like I feel like a lot of times when people go on podcasts, people do it for clout. Mm. Right? They do it because they're trying to give glory to themselves.
Yeah.
And for me, I just felt like that was not what I'm about and what I'm trying to do. But I remember I was in the car coming home from our Wednesday Bible study, and one of our visiting pastors from Australia was around. Mm-hmm. And we were listening to the podcast I was telling you about earlier,
the one
by Tim Ross in the
car.
Right. And I happened to put it on pause.
Yeah.
And he tells me, he's like, "Hey, I feel like you have a really good podcast voice." And I was like, "Why do people keep talking to me about podcasts?"
Right.
And I was like, "All right, let me submit and
let actually, me get one done."
Yeah. So yeah, it's the first one.
Yeah, I mean, Franklin told me there's this guy I need you to talk to. He's raised millions of dollars and would be really good for the podcast, would be really good for people to understand, I guess, the process of investing and angel investing, especially in Africa. And I was like, yeah, for sure. Let's make this happen.
Yeah.
So I'm happy that we're doing this. We are shooting this on a public holiday. So I will also say thanks for coming in.
taking your time off
to come on a public holiday. I'm going to start this conversation on a really interesting, for me at least, interesting point of view, because we were chatting and you were telling me how you decided, or you knew that you were going to marry your wife within five minutes of meeting with her.
Yeah.
That's incredible for me, because this being a financial podcast, I have to ask you, when you're making that decision or even that daydream or whatever the case is, are you not at all thinking about money? Because, I mean, after you get married, you know, it's life. Are you not thinking about money at all? Like, how much money you're making or how much money she's making? Is that not a factor for you at all at that time?
No. It's not at all, because I feel like, for me, marriage is a partnership for you to bring forward what God has called you to bring forward.
Yeah.
Right? And I feel like within the confines of that, if you are obedient, you will be blessed. Mm-hmm. Right? And one of the things that, especially as I've now started taking that journey, that I advise my mentees and my friends, is that honestly, particularly for men, right, there is a discipline if you do marriage right. Let me be clear about that.
Right.
There is a discipline that marriage gives you, and there's a stability that marriage gives you that allows you to take more risks.
Yeah.
Right? If I share a little bit about the story about Baki Beauty, and I know we'll get back to it.
Yeah.
My wife played a very, very critical role in me starting this company. Mm-hmm. Right? Before I started Baki, I was actually at Good Life. So I had just left Wesoko from full-time. I'm still involved as an equity shareholder and as an advisor to the CEO of Wasoko. But when I left, I wanted to do something in the healthcare space. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Good Life, and at Good Life, I helped set up all of Good Life's digital business. Mm-hmm. And I built that business. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, there were some frustrations that came along the way.
Yeah.
Right. And as you can imagine, being part of a bigger corporate, there's only so much you can do when you want to change something. The structure of how things yeah. move. Right. And I remember my wife telling me, like, hey, I feel like you should go start this company. And I was like, no, let me buy the company I've built from Good Life.
Right.
And I literally actually raised the money to buy the company I built from Good Life.
Yeah.
And she was kept telling me, like, I feel like you should go start this. And I remember I was in the car on my way to see this missionary mm-hmm. who'd prayed for my parents before I was born. Mm-hmm. And in the car, the Lord telling me, like, you got to do the thing you're most afraid of. Mm-hmm. Right. And the thing I was most afraid of was starting
the company. Right.
Right. And so the point I'm trying to make is that some of the biggest risks that will then also unlock, you know, more financial gain for you
yeah.
comes from the stability of having a wife that is also submitted to God alongside you.
Right.
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 And so I think thinking about money at that time really was not on my mind.
Yeah.
Right. What was on my mind was I saw someone who I felt in my heart mm-hmm. God was calling me to marry.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure, like I was telling you.
Yeah.
And so what I told her was, one, either we're going to get married
yeah.
or we're going to be really, really good friends.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's something here.
Yeah.
Right? And I want to understand what is...
What's the connection here?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. That's incredible. I mean, I'm married and I didn't make the decision within the first 5 minutes. I mean, I did pretty soon. I felt it was pretty soon. It wasn't within the first 5 minutes, but it was pretty soon. And I, to be honest, I also didn't think about financial considerations. No, it wasn't a thing that was, I don't even know how much money I was making at the time, but yeah, it wasn't a factor. Just like, yeah, this is someone that I want to connect with, and I did it. But I wonder though, whether, you know, because they say finances is number one reason for divorce. Mm. So I wonder whether it should be more of a consideration before you get married. What if you were to make that decision in a vacuum, so to speak, like, you know, even remove yourself from your own marriage and be like, yeah, would it be a wiser decision to actually think about it and talk about it with your partner before even proposing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I think. One thing that we did do very early on,
yeah,
and I think this is interesting because I've had this conversation with a number of folks, right? There's the whole, like, her account is her account.
Right, your account is...
My account is our account.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I remember we talked about that very early on about, you know, how do we split money, right? And I was actually very transparent with her. Mm-hmm. Right, about one.
By the way, his wife is seated right here. That's why he keeps pointing.
Oh yes,
to her.
Sorry. Yeah. About that, yes. I was very transparent with her about one, how much I make, two, what are the investments I have, right, and what is the value of my equity holdings.
Yeah.
Right. So I think having that transparency of, like, where are you coming from financially, right? Where am I coming from financially?
Yeah.
What is your risk appetite?
Yeah.
What is my risk appetite, and are we aligned?
Yeah.
Right. And then making sure that it's not just a one-time conversation.
Yeah.
And one thing that I always say is that actions speak louder than words. Mm-hmm. Right. Because you can have that conversation.
Yeah.
But if you see that even after that conversation where she tells you our money is our money, meaning my money is also your money.
Yeah.
But when it comes to doing things around the house.
Yeah.
When it comes to doing things when you go out.
Yeah.
If there's a reluctance from your girlfriend, if it's your girlfriend at the time, or your fiance to spend any money or contribute, then actions speak louder than words.
Yeah.
Right? And so I would say, like, the one thing about my wife was that, you know, when we would go out, right, there's times where she'd be like, yo, this is me taking you on a date.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to cover this.
Yeah.
Right? Or, like, when my birthday comes, right? She's big on birthdays.
Yeah.
I'm like, yo, it's my birthday, right? But she was like, no, I want to take you here.
Yeah.
I want to do this. And she's like, I'm going to pay for it. Right? And I've had a funny story on that.
Yeah.
I've had a situation where I was dating someone who told me the same thing.
Yeah.
But they took my credit card and paid for my own birthday. And so back to the point about actions speak louder than words, right? Like, you gotta also assess how the person's moving.
Yeah.
More than just what they're saying.
I mean, let me ask you a further question. Because we are going to get into your story, but I have a question on why money is such a... Why you think, in your experience, money is such a prickly thing. Mm. That's, for example, the girlfriend you've talked about who would say, yeah, I'll spend money, but I'll spend your money on your birthday. Like, why is money such a thing? Like, why are we so attached to this money thing?
Yeah.
And why do you want to have it so much? Of course, I mean, and I know the obvious reasons.
Answers, but yeah. No, it's a good question. And this is something I theorize about quite a bit. And it ties, I tie a lot of things to Baki because I think a lot of what we are trying to do speaks to really getting at the heart of identity and finding who you are.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times we see money as a tool of becoming that person who we want to be, right? Versus recognizing that we can be that person in spite of our financial situation. Yeah. And so what do I mean by that? I think particularly in an African context, right? And as someone, as you mentioned at the start, right? I've lived both in the continent, but I've lived in the UK, I've lived in the US, right? I've grown up in a predominantly American context, but I have also spent a lot of time in the continent.
Yeah.
And one thing that I've seen about Black people globally is that we do have, unfortunately, a scarcity mindset,
right?
I think some of it is generational in the fact that only recently did we just come out of colonialism, right? Like we don't really like take time
but it's
to
true.
Realize
that
colonialism was only 60-something years ago, right?
Yeah, it wasn't too long.
Like most of our grandparents, some of our parents were actually born before our countries got independence, right? And in that colonial environment, we didn't have much. We didn't own much, right? So we were left to own the crumbs.
Yeah.
And so as a result, we fought for the crumbs,
right?
And so I think nowadays we've carried that mindset of, okay, because I didn't have, now is my time to have.
Yeah.
I deserve it,
yeah.
Right? And so as a result of that, that is why we carry that selfishness, because it comes from a mindset that the pie is fixed and the pie can't grow.
Yeah.
And because the pie can't grow, I need to take as much as I can for myself versus looking and saying, how do we grow the pie? Because if we grow the pie, all of us get to have abundance.
Yeah.
All of us get to live in abundance, right? So I think it's the difference between an abundance mindset and a scarcity mindset,
right?
So I think that's where it comes from.
Okay. That makes sense, you know. I guess, she'd rather spend your money on a date and keep hers. Okay.
But the question is, what is she doing with hers? Is she investing it or is she just spending it?
I don't know. I think people just like to have money sometimes, you know.
That's like, just look at it.
Like I think if you feel like your account is you know depreciating and like you're losing money, just like I'm losing money. And you don't like that feeling. Anyway, let's get into it. So I'll start right off with asking you, what do you think your folks taught you about money? Whether it was direct or indirect, what do you think they taught you about money?
So that's a really good question. I will start predominantly with my mother because in my life story, I think one of the most influential people in my life is my mom, right? And I lived with her. There was a period of time where, because of circumstance, my parents were not living in the same place. They were still married, but they were just not living in the same place.
Yeah.
And I think when I lived with my mom in the period when I was in the US, right, and that was from the age of about 7, 8 to about 10, 11, my mom at the time, she was going through a lot of medical issues.
Okay.
Right? So she didn't have a consistent job.
Okay.
Right? And as much as my dad was working, my dad was just at a period in his career where things hadn't really taken off, right? And so as a result, my mom was very, very disciplined with money and she budgeted like crazy, right? To the point where I think I've carried that mindset.
Yeah.
And my mom tells me that now I've become like the budget czar in the house,
right?
Where I'm like, yo, hold on. Like, is this a financially responsible decision? Like, what are you guys trying to do here?
Right.
And so I think that aspect of being very frugal with money and being very managed in how you spend, I think came from my mom.
Yeah.
Right. So I would say one thing about my personality till date, right? And my wife is the big one who always tries to tell me that I need to learn to spend on myself.
Okay.
Right. Is I don't really care about I need to wear Gucci, Louis Vuitton, all that stuff. Doesn't matter how wealthy I am, how much money's in my account. I just don't feel like that's what validates me.
Okay.
Right. And so I would say that came from my mom in terms of money habits, right? I'd say one thing that came from my grandfather, who's an economist, and I'm an economist, is the investing side. And so my grandfather and my uncle, my dad's older brother, both did quite a bit of investing when I was younger, and they would talk to me about it. And so I would say my interest, one, in economics, two, in financial markets, and that really grew during the 07, 08 crisis, came from them, where I realized that if you want to be wealthy, earning a salary is not how you become wealthy.
Right.
Ownership is how you become wealthy.
Right.
Right. And so I learned that lesson very early on And I started creating mock portfolios. Mm-hmm. So that's how I started looking at investing when I was in high school, mm-hmm. even before I got to college.
Yeah.
So I'd say that came from my uncle and my grandfather. Mm-hmm. And then I'd say from my dad. My dad's very interesting. My dad, he just likes doing his work. He doesn't really pay attention to money.
Right.
And I would say the one thing about my dad that I would say my dad taught me, both good and bad, mm-hmm. is one, generosity. Mm-hmm. Right. In my dad's family, my dad is one of the most successful in his family. Mm-hmm. And for context, you know, they came from a situation where my dad, I think he had one pair of shoes till he was like 10 years old or something.
Right.
I don't know the exact story. Yeah. But, yeah.
but along, yeah, along
that those, level of poverty. Right. Yeah. Right. And to go from that level of poverty in Cameroon mm-hmm. to my dad has a PhD in genetics. Mm-hmm. Right. In the 80s, he has a PhD as a black man in genetics in the US.
Right.
Right. And to then lift himself out of that
yeah.
to a place where he can, you know, build houses for his brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. Right. Ensure that our family land remains within the family, mm-hmm. but isn't sold off mm-hmm. in order for people to feed their kids.
Right.
Put my cousins through school.
Yeah.
Right. His generosity. I mean, I can't even count how many of my cousins my dad has put through school.
Yeah.
Right. And how my dad would tell me, look, this money that I would give you to go hang out with your friends is going to pay your cousin's school fees.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm not going to give it to you.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'd say that generosity.
Yeah.
But I would say the other thing that I learned on the flip side is enablement of family members. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I'd say is a little bit different in how I think about money versus yeah. my parents. Is my dad's brother, unfortunately, you know, he got into bad habits, okay. alcoholism being one of them.
Right.
And, you know, he just doesn't take care of money. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, my dad has continued to give
him money
and enable
right.
sometimes
right.
that behavior. I'm right. seeing him learning and stopping.
Yeah.
But I would say very early on, that was something that I told myself I'm not going to do.
Okay.
Right? I'm going to invest in productive things like education and stuff for people.
Yeah.
But I'm not just going to give you money, you know, with no strings.
Right. Right.
So I would say that those are sort of some of the lessons that I've learned.
Okay. A question, and I guess your family and how you guys ended up moving around. Mm-hmm. Was it for, I guess, as, you know, as the colloquial saying is searching for a better
opportunity.
Better opportunity. Was mm-hmm. that the case? And so how many different countries did you end up living in? Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely. Ethiopia was definitely searching for a better opportunity. Mm-hmm. My dad was a researcher in Ethiopia. When my dad went to South Africa, mm-hmm. I went to Cameroon when my dad was in South Africa because mm-hmm. my dad moved to South Africa right before the end of apartheid.
Okay.
And he was a professor in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so his concern was like having a black family
in apartheid South Africa. Yeah.
He was like, nah, like, I think it'll be better for you to live elsewhere. So definitely it was a lot of that.
Yeah.
I would say he really started getting some stability when we moved to Côte d'Ivoire mm-hmm. in 1999. Mm-hmm. And that's when he started working with the African Development Bank. Mm-hmm. And then he was with the African Development Bank until he retired in 2020?
Yeah.
Right? But because of the war in Ivory Coast, that's what moved him from Ivory Coast to Tunisia.
Yeah.
And that's what moved me to the US initially. Mm. Because there was a civil war that broke out in Ivory Coast.
Yeah.
So those other moves from the year 2000 to about the year 2007 was mostly driven either by war mm-hmm. or me being in the habit of moving.
Right.
Where, funny story, I put together a presentation. Mm-hmm. And I applied to boarding school in the UK. Mm-hmm. I got in and then I came to my parents and I gave them the tuition bill.
Yeah.
And I told them, I'm going to the UK and here's why.
Yeah.
And here's why you need to pay.
Yeah.
My parents were like, what? But I made a whole investment case of like me going to the UK is going to be financially better for you.
Yeah. And so did you end up going
to the UK? Yeah, I ended up going to the UK.
Based off your presentation?
Based on that.
Okay.
Based on that.
Yeah.
And so that move to the UK was driven more by me being in the habit of moving so much when we were staying in Tunisia for 5 years, I was like, yo, this is way too long.
Yeah.
I need to change.
Do something different.
I need to change.
Cool.
Yeah.
First time you made money?
First time I made money, how old was I? I was like 14.
Yeah.
I think I was like 14. And that was the car wash business.
Yeah.
So that started off from, I used to feel like my parents used to give me 21 questions on why I needed money.
Yeah.
What was I going to do with the money? And I remember telling myself, look, you know, I'm tired of answering all these questions.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're 14 years old. As a 14-year-old boy, there's things you want to do that you're not trying to talk about with your parents.
Yeah.
So you're like, please just give me the money. Yeah. Let me go do my thing.
Yeah.
But because they said no, I decided, let me go figure out how to make money.
Yeah.
And I realized there was a local car wash just down the street in Tunisia that everyone in the neighborhood used to go to. Mm-hmm. So I decided to undercut the car wash.
Yeah.
And sell my services at 50% their price.
Yeah.
And who can say no to a 14-year-old kid?
Yeah.
Right? Trying to make some money.
Yeah.
So that was how I made my first money.
And when you're making that money, what are you spending it? Like, is it coming and going completely? Are you saving any of it? You said you've gotten, you know.
Yeah. So I would say in the beginning I started spending it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Because it was new. You were like, wow, I got a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so you want to show the girls that you have some money.
Yeah.
Right. And so in the beginning I would spend it. But then I realized that I could use the money to make more money.
Yeah.
And that's when I started getting into parties.
Yeah.
And so my friends and I would use the money to go rent out beaches and other places.
Yeah.
And we would throw parties and we would charge for these parties.
Yeah.
And so that's when I really started thinking about, without realizing the language around it,
yeah,
investing.
Yeah.
Right, investing in an idea,
yeah,
taking some risk, and then making more money on that money.
Yeah.
Right, and so I would say it transitioned from just spending it,
yeah,
to realizing that, hey, I need to invest this money.
Yeah.
Right, so I would say there was a change.
That's a shift after the initial, you know, chop the money. Okay, so I want to fast forward to when you now get into uni, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you told me about how you bought a club that was valued at $1.2 million.
Yeah.
So tell me about why you even wanted to buy the club. With your friends, for starters. Is it because you were spending that much money? You know, we had someone from the NSC here a couple of episodes ago, and she was telling us if you drink EABL products, you need to own shares at EABL.
Absolutely.
So was it partly like you're spending so much time in this club, you might be the beneficiary of the club? Yeah.
So funny story, yeah, right? To your point. In Tunisia,
yeah,
we used to throw parties in Tunisia,
mm-hmm,
and make money throwing parties.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went to uni in Chicago, at first, I actually joined a fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
And I became the DJ at the fraternity. I became the bartender. And we would make money.
Question on the fraternity, sorry. Because I have no experience, personal experience with any fraternities. Mm-hmm. Is it literally like we see on the movies and the series? And like you guys doing, you know, like running around naked and like being hazed? And all these crazy things
I'm sworn to secrecy. So I can't reveal everything. I can't reveal everything on air.
Yeah.
But I would say there is some truth.
There is some truth to the
recklessness that take place.
Okay.
You know, boys
will
be boys.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we used to throw wild parties,
mm-hmm,
at our fraternity house.
Yeah.
We had like a huge mansion.
Yeah.
Right. So the name of my fraternity is Phi Delta Theta. Theta.
Mm-hmm.
Theta. So if anybody wants to Google that, you could see our house,
right?
It's a big house. And so we used to throw parties at that house. And I realized we were making so much money throwing parties.
Mm-hmm.
And a good friend of mine and I decided that we wanted to go to downtown Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And we had been invited there by another friend of a friend,
mm-hmm,
who was hosting some girls from Northwestern,
mm-hmm,
and wanted to invite some guys to the club.
Yeah.
And so this was happening on like a Wednesday, Thursday.
Yeah.
And so he called me and said, hey, I don't have enough girls relative to the number of guys that are coming.
Yeah.
Can you and your friend organize more girls to come?
Yeah.
I'll send a bus
to
your campus to come pick up these girls.
Right.
And so that was my introduction.
And by girls here, we mean like just people of the female gender. Not,
yes.
Not like strippers or...
No. We just mean other college females.
Yeah, okay.
Yes,
yeah. Just to qualify.
Just to qualify.
Yeah. Okay.
And so we would take the bus to downtown.
Yeah.
And the whole idea was if you have a party and there's a lot of girls at the party...
Yeah. Many guys will come.
Many guys will show up and they'll spend.
Yeah.
And they'll actually even pay to get in.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's how I got into being a promoter.
Yeah.
Right? And it started with an older guy who had been doing it for a while. And then he brought my friend and I into kind of that business.
Yeah.
And so that's what we started doing.
Yeah.
And then we built a relationship with a club owner who had owned a club in downtown Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he realized he was making more money on the nights that we would promote at his club,
mm-hmm,
than he was on his regular nights.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sat us down by the time we were in our third year,
mm-hmm,
in uni, because US is usually 4 years.
Yeah.
And he was like, hey, I feel like you guys are basically running this place.
Yeah.
So I would love to hand it over to you guys.
Yeah.
You know, I want to retire. He was in his 60s. And so he told us, look, here's how much I'm willing to sell this to you, $1.2 million.
Yeah.
He's like, you guys are great, great men, right? I really appreciate you guys. So you don't have to pay everything up front.
Yeah.
So he's like, you tell me how much you can pay me up front.
Yeah.
And then whatever else you can't pay me out of the profits of the business.
Yeah.
Right? And so my friend and I then decided with the promoter guy who had brought us into the business, the three of us, we were the three main guys. We decided we would raise up to about 30% of the asking price.
Right.
Pay that to him up front and then finance the rest.
Okay.
Because we built a financial model saying, okay, if we were running this club,
how much money would we
make? How much more money we would make? What's the timeline we want to pay this guy back? And so where it came from was the fact that we built a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think a lot of things in business for me, and a lot, what you'll realize, a lot of my stories in business come from relationships,
mm-hmm.
right? Building a relationship and just genuinely investing in the relationship mm-hmm. without realizing that there's something that's going to come from it.
Right.
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 And so we built a relationship with this club owner. We stood right by him. We did right by him.
Yeah.
We paid him what for he was due
years. Yeah.
for
yeah.
3 years.
Yeah.
And then he's the one who came to us and said, hey, well, I'll sell to you.
Yeah.
Right. So that's how it happened.
Okay.
And as I was telling you, funny story. I was not even 21
at the time.
Right.
It happened,
and in the US, you're supposed to be 21.
Right. Right. Right.
So
right.
I was not even 21.
Yeah.
And I couldn't sign.
Yeah.
So I had to get my cousin in New York.
Yeah.
To sign for me.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't sign the legal papers.
Right. Okay. So how do you raise? If I remember correctly, you said you raised the, because it's now what, $400,000 that you're raising?
Yeah. It was about $400,000.
Dollars. So that you raised with family, friends.
Yes. And, so it was family, friends. There was a friend of one of the guys who threw in about $250,000.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so he came from a wealthy family in Chicago.
Yeah.
And he was a partier.
Yeah.
Right.
So he was like,
we sold him the story of, look, you're spending money at these clubs.
This club anyway. Yeah.
Why not make money where you're already spending?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so he was like, all right, it makes sense.
Okay.
Right. And so he threw in $250,000. We got some money from our parents. And then we raised from some other friends.
Yeah, and you're able to get it. So how long does it take you to pay back the whole 1.2?
It took us, we bought the club officially in 2013, 2014.
Yeah.
We paid it off by 2016, 2017.
Okay.
We were done.
Okay.
Yeah, so about 4 years.
Yeah.
So about 4 years.
That was like I guess that's like a good relationship. And I have an interesting question around that.
Mm.
Do you think a situation like that or even an opportunity like that and not purely from like the retirement perspective,
mm-hmm.
but genuinely, do you think there's an opportunity like that can happen in an African context or in a Nairobi context? I mean, you've been doing business in Nairobi for a while now. Do you think an opportunity like that can avail itself where someone's like, okay, yeah, give me 30% of the asking price and you can pay the rest in 4 years based on the profits?
Funny story. There's an opportunity. I won't share too much because it's a deal I'm working on right now.
Oh, kind of, okay.
There's a deal I'm working on right now
right.
that looks something like that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So there's a seller who wants to move his family to the US
mm-hmm.
and he's looking to sell his family business.
Mm.
And we are negotiating something like that mm-hmm. where the negotiations will pay you a certain percentage up front.
Right.
We'll pay you the balance over X period of time based on an earn-out structure.
Right.
And then you can own the balance in shares, right? And so that's something we're actually looking at right now. And so I do think opportunities like that.
For a 20-year-old?
19, 20-year-old.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, look, I think it comes back to what are the circles you put yourself in,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, one thing I always try to do is never sleep on where someone is,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, when I joined the fraternity that I joined, I'll tell a very interesting story on this, is when I joined the fraternity that I joined, the first ever job that I got was because I met this girl at a party
mm-hmm.
that we were hosting,
mm-hmm.
and she happened to be a senior.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm being very honest, when I started the conversation trying to hit on her.
Yeah.
And we just ended up talking about business and life.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me, hey, I'm about to leave an internship to go take a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you make a really, really good replacement.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, is it okay if I throw your name in the ring?
Yeah.
Like, I can't guarantee you anything, but like,
yeah,
at least you get an interview.
Yeah.
Right. And so the point I'm trying to make is like, you know, when you walk into a situation,
mm-hmm.
always allow yourself to just like be available to what can happen.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of times people you try to think too hard about a situation where it's like, no, I want it to go this way. I want it to go that way.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to say is like, be open to possibilities.
Yeah.
Right? Because a lot of what has happened in my life and a lot of how I've gotten to where I am
was
I had a plan, new plans presented themselves.
Yeah.
And I was open enough to say, hey, let me consider this plan.
Yeah.
I don't know where this is going to go.
Yeah.
But let me give it a good consideration.
Yeah.
And then let me play it out to its final conclusion. Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, this is your third year, getting your fourth year by the time you're passing this club. So, around that time, I guess just before you start working, how much money are you making around that time? Like, what are your monthly expenses looking like? Ooh. And are you saving? Are you investing? Or is it still spending?
Yeah. How much money are we making at that time? At that time, we were probably making, individually about $3,000 to $5,000 a month.
Okay.
Yeah. And was I saving as much when I was then? I was putting a lot into our hedge fund that we were managing.
Right.
And so any saving I was doing was going into that. One thing that I feel like I was a bit arrogant of me, if I'm being very honest, and was that I thought I was like the ish when it came to investing.
Right.
Because we had done very well with our hedge fund.
And I'll ask you about the hedge fund after this. So actually, maybe you can just give context about the hedge fund now. Yeah.
So I started a hedge fund with a few friends of mine from college, Nick and Levine.
Yeah.
We started the hedge fund towards the end of our first year in college. And we started with about $5,000. We were very successful. We grew it to almost over $200,000.
Yeah.
With the hedge fund, we applied two different investment strategies.
Mm-hmm.
We did fundamentals equity investing, right? Which is your classic kind of Buffett, finding, cigarette butts and investing in low valued companies that you think are going to outperform.
Yeah.
And then we also did what's known as merger arbitrage.
Mm-hmm.
So merger arbitrage basically looks at, if a company, like I'll just use local companies, say Airtel is buying Telkom, you will buy Telkom stock, right, at call it 100 shillings a share with the hope that Airtel will buy the company
and then
at 300 shillings a share
right.
and you make 3x your money, right?
Right, right.
And so that's what we used to do.
Yeah.
Was we would look at, particularly in the US with large acquisitions, there was always the risk of regulatory scrutiny.
Yeah.
And so the game was, if you can find the company, get in early enough, using options and other leveraged products, you could make multiple of your money.
Yeah.
So that was what we did. And I think we were very successful very early, right? I think part of it was we were in a bull market, if we're being honest, right? And a rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah.
So we took it to meaning that we were good.
We were good, yeah.
And so any money I was making from my nightlife was going into that.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really putting money away for like for a rainy day, right? And so that's how I built up that investment portfolio.
Yeah.
And so in terms of my expenses, I would say good thing my parents were paying my tuition. Eventually rent was on me. And so rent was about $500 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Between food and going out, I was probably spending another $500 to $1,000, right? We have to remember these were the early days of Uber, right?
Yeah, right, right.
And so there wasn't like, you could just Uber everywhere. Yeah, you had to take a cab.
Yeah.
Right? And cabs were a lot more expensive.
Yeah.
So transport was expensive because we lived in Southside Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're going out, in downtown Chicago.
Yeah.
And then also being a promoter, right? You spend money.
Yeah.
You buy bottles.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, I always felt like the money I was spending was coming back because it would bring people would see what we would post on Facebook and they'd want to come out with us.
Yeah.
I think I was probably putting aside probably about 20-30% of what I was earning at the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So is Goldman Sachs then the first official job that you work once you're done?
Yeah. So Goldman Sachs is the first official job that I have after I graduate.
Yeah.
Right. Before that I had done quasi work, quasi internships. I was one of those people where I honestly spent a lot of my uni years making money than I did going to class.
Right.
Right. Because as I mentioned with the story, I went for that interview, after I met that girl at the fraternity, I got that job.
Yeah.
Right. And I started as an intern and then I became a part-time analyst with that investment bank. And then they are the ones who introduced me to Blackstone, mm-hmm. which is how I got into private equity. Mm-hmm. And then from Blackstone, I realized that if I wanted to get to a place where I was making decisions on investing early on, my mentor at Blackstone advised that I went to Goldman. Mm-hmm. He told me Goldman's the only place on Wall Street that's going to give you capital early enough for you to make decisions.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's why I went to Goldman.
Yeah.
And so when I...
Was it difficult? What was the process and the competition like getting
into Goldman? Oh, getting to Goldman?
Yeah.
Goldman's hard. Goldman's hard. I mean, the acceptance rate at the time I got in was like 1.5-2%.
Yeah.
Right.
What is it that you had that, you know, you think sort of, you know, allowed you to stand out and be like, yeah, we want this guy?
I think entrepreneurial experience.
Yeah.
Right. I'd already been investing. And not just a mock portfolio. I'd been putting my money at risk. And so I could speak to that.
Yeah.
I could speak to, hey, here's my track record.
Yeah.
So I had track record that they could see, which I think they appreciated. I think I had humility that I wanted to learn.
Yeah.
Right, which I think they appreciated, because I would say it was probably one of the hardest interview processes I've ever been in. Mm-hmm. Right. I think when I interviewed with Goldman, I actually interviewed for three different divisions. Mm-hmm. So within Goldman Sachs, if I just give a little bit of context, there's the trading division, mm-hmm. there's the asset management, which is purely investing, mm-hmm. and then there's the investment banking.
Yeah.
When they had me interview for all three, which meant 18 interviews in one day.
Wow.
Right, because I made it through every round for each of the divisions.
Yeah.
And it was a gruesome day.
Yeah.
And the other thing they test for that I realize now looking back is they're testing for resilience.
Yeah.
Because I always tell people, I've never worked, probably maybe never worked. I probably still work the same. I think my wife would say I probably still work to the same level of intensity.
Yeah.
Although I do try to create a bit more balance between family and work. But when I was there, if I just walk you through my schedule, I used to wake up at 4:30 every day. Mm-hmm. I would be in the gym by 5. Mm-hmm. I'll be done in the gym by 6, mm-hmm. showered and on the dress by on the desk by 6:30. Mm-hmm. And I would leave the desk by 6:37 p.m. Mm-hmm. We would go to a client dinner. Mm-hmm. We'd be at a client dinner till 10. Mm-hmm. I'd go back to the office and I would work till midnight, 1 a.m., and then go home. I used to live by the office.
Yeah.
Go home, do it all over again. Sleeping like
3-4 hours a night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like that was what we did.
Yeah.
That was what we did. And I would say the interview process in a way was shadowing that.
Yeah.
Right? Because it showed you that you had to have the persistence.
To be able to just
kind of push through.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of probably what they were looking for as well was... those who may have done well in their first two interviews,
but then by their last interviews
couldn't maintain the momentum.
Yeah.
Versus those who were consistent throughout the interview process.
Yeah. And how much are they paying you for working essentially 18 hours a day? Yeah.
So when you do the math on your hourly wage, you cry. You're not being paid that well. Because you're working 100-hour weeks.
Yeah.
And your base salary was $90,000.
Yeah.
So $90,000 in a Kenyan context sounds like a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I'll give you context for like expenses in New York, right? So if you're making 90, that's pre-tax, right? Mm-hmm. New York taxes are wild, right? Especially being a single man, you're probably paying 35% of your income between federal, state, city tax. Mm-hmm. And then your rent... Right. I was living in a 2-bedroom apartment that my friends and I flexed into a 4-bedroom because it was that big.
Right.
So we could flex it into a 4-bedroom. Right. And I was paying probably $1,500, $1,500 a month in rent.
Right.
Right. That was just rent cost.
Yeah.
And then if you add going out in New York, right, you're spending probably another $1,500 between food and everything.
Right.
Because like lunch in New York is like $30.
Mm.
Right?
It's not cheap.
It's not cheap. So I would say, you know, 90 is your base when you start. If you do well, the way Goldman usually takes care of you when you start is they give their top tier analyst stocks. Mm-hmm. So I actually got equity in Goldman, right? So I got equity worth $5,000 when I started. Mm-hmm. And then I got my first year bonus was about $30,000. Mm-hmm. Right. And so all in, that was 120.
120, yeah.
Year one. Year two, you got bumped to about 100,000 base. Mm-hmm. And then your bonus year two was about anywhere between 50 to 75,000. Mm-hmm. Right. So all in, you can make 175,000.
Yeah.
Year three, you got bumped to 110 base. Mm-hmm. And your bonus there was anywhere from 100 to 200,000.
Okay.
Right. And then year three, you get bumped to 150.
Yeah.
And then it scales up as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is that progression for everybody? Like once you're in the system, the like you're fine.
The first year, 25% of your starting class gets pushed out.
Like to like, you know, thanks, like cheers, like, yeah. You know, see like, you later.
Basically.
Yeah.
Basically. If you fall into the bottom percentile of people's performance,
and that's you get pushed out. And that's based on the amount of money that you're making the company?
Yes. Especially if you're in a trading seat. So it depends on the seat you're in.
Yeah.
But if you're in a trading seat, like the seat I was in.
Yeah.
When I started, I was a desk analyst.
Yeah.
So I was basically making investment recommendations to portfolio managers who would invest.
Yeah.
And I was then given attribution for the share of revenue that I was generating through my my investment recommendations. Yeah. Yeah. And so I was given a revenue target.
Yeah. What's the pressure like? Like, okay, fine. I you know, even if now you're telling me this space, because I'm like, yeah, that's lucrative. And I'm like, I definitely want to be in on that gain train, right? But I'm like, what's the pressure? What does the pressure feel like, you know, when you're on a day-to-day basis? And like you're saying, yeah, you're having to work these 18-hour days week after week after month after month after year.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the money looks good, but you have to keep performing.
Mm.
You know, and the reason I'm asking that partly is because I have an uncle who believes that but some of these more developed markets, the individuals who work at these high performance firms, like there's a very few percentage of people in the world who can work in that kind of environment, and that you can't, not everybody is able to like sustain it.
No. I have many friends who, by the end of year one, part of what the environment does is you self-select.
Mm-hmm.
So I had friends who halfway through self-selected. They're like, no, I can't do this.
Yeah. It's just like,
because honestly, you like, your dating life is non-existent.
Yeah.
Right, unless you're dating somebody.
But you tell me, like, what does that actually mean? Because you know, it's fine to like hear the words and be like, I don't have a dating life. I'm working 18 hours. But like, what does that, like, if you're to try and make me experience what actually working 18 hours a day for five, six days a week looks like and feels like?
Like sometimes seven days a week.
Yeah.
Sometimes 7 days a week.
Yeah.
Look, I think you have to honestly be motivated by more than just the money.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be motivated by this sense of like, I cannot fail.
Yeah.
Right. And at all cost, I am refusing to fail.
Yeah.
Because if money is the only thing that's motivating you,
excuse me. Yeah.
Right. Eventually you get to a place where you're like, no, I could make money elsewhere.
Yeah.
Right. And so I would say the pressure is one of like, you're unwilling to fail.
Yeah.
Right. And because you're unwilling to fail, you're willing to burn the midnight oil.
Yeah.
Right. You're willing to, I back then, I mean, I drink a lot more coffee than I do now.
Yeah.
I used to do at least 6 espresso shots a day.
Mm-hmm.
I would do at least 1 5-hour energy, 1 Red Bull.
A day.
And I would be in the gym for at least an hour.
Yeah.
Right. And that was, the gym was like my sanity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I would run in the gym for context. Let me translate this to kilometers. What's 5 kilometers? What's 5 miles in kilometers?
5 miles is 8 kilometers.
Yeah. I would run 8 kilometers a day.
Yeah.
6 days a week.
Yeah.
Just to keep
just my sanity. Just to keep your mind.
Yeah. And part of it was why, I mean, I'm sure people have heard this, right?
Yeah.
There's a reason why on Wall Street people do cocaine.
Yeah.
People do Adderall.
Right.
Because the pressure is so much.
Yeah.
And part of what makes the pressure so much is the size of the numbers you're dealing with.
Yeah.
Right? We were talking a bit about this before we went on air.
I was going to ask you. Yeah, tell us about the $50 million.
Yeah. So dollars, when I started, I was managing, the first ever portfolio I got was probably $5 million.
Yeah.
And it was given to me very casually. Right. But when you're coming, like, I gave a bit of my background, right? Like, my family has done well.
Yeah.
But, like, we're not just playing around with $5 million.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Right. And I was just given $5 million, like, hey, this is your book. You make decisions on where you want to invest this $5 million. Right. And by 7 months in, the guy who had hired me quit because he didn't make partner that year. And he was managing $1 billion. And so the guy who ran our team.
Yeah.
Right, I never forget this. The guy who ran our team calls me into his office and he's like, remind me what school you went to? I'm like, UChicago. He's like, what'd you study? I'm like, economics. He's like, I think you'll do a good job. I'm like, what you mean? He's like, we're not hiring anybody else. You're gonna run that book. So I was given 7 months in. I'm like, I was basically, I just turned 21.
Yeah.
right? You're basically given $1 billion to manage.
Yeah.
Right? On the one hand, someone can view that as being completely reckless by Goldman.
Right, right.
To give me... But on the other hand, like, back to how Goldman recruits people.
Yeah.
They look for people who failure is not an option.
Yeah.
And for me, failure was not an option.
Yeah.
So, like, I needed to figure out how I was going to manage that and make money.
So, I mean, when he tells you that, are you excited? Are you like...
No, I was terrified.
Yeah.
I was terrified. And, like, if I was being honest, I didn't sleep very well for, like, a few weeks, right? Because I was always triple-checking my work.
Yeah.
I was scared that I was going to lose money.
Yeah.
And I remember the day that I did lose money when oil dropped from $100 a barrel to $29 a barrel, and I was down $50 million.
Yeah.
I was completely, like, terrified out of my mind.
Yeah.
Because I was trying to figure out, like, what do we do?
Yeah.
Right? I knew my positioning was right.
Yeah.
But the market had moved against me.
Yeah.
Right? And I was telling you the story of that day my boss called me into his office. Yeah. Right? Because the way Goldman works, just for context for people, is you can't hide that you're down, right?
Yeah.
Everybody can see everybody's P&L.
Right.
So I can see how much the guy down the row for me.
So even when you're saying you're coming into your class and your cohort, like, you know what everybody's making.
You know how much everybody's making.
So if you fall behind, like,
you can see that you're falling behind. So let me tell you, look, Wall Street firms are designed to create pressure and competition.
Right.
Like, that's the design.
Yeah.
Because it's a funnel, right?
Yeah.
There's only 400 partners at Goldman Sachs at any given point.
Yeah.
If you want to be, Goldman Sachs employs 45,000 people. So think about that funnel. 45,000 people to 400 partners.
Yeah.
If you want to be at the top, it is Hunger Games.
Yeah.
To get to the top.
Yeah.
Right? And they create that very early on.
Yeah.
Right? And so you need to be of a certain personality, right, to be that hungry and that competitive.
Yeah.
Right? Which is what you find a lot of times is athletes who do really well in those environments.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So it's not always the most intellectual people, but it's the most competitive people.
What's the most cutthroat thing that you saw or witnessed or that you did? Because do you psych out the other person? Like, do you actually try and psych out your colleagues or be like, yeah, no, don't make that trade? Or, you know, I don't know. I mean, do you use every tool you possibly can to ensure that you make it?
I mean, look, I think you, let me think about that. That's a good question. Did I ever do anything like that? Maybe I did. Maybe I did. I can't remember.
If you know and you and you're in the comments, tell us. Tell us what you did.
Maybe I did. But I'll tell you a story of what I've seen one of our traders do.
Yeah.
And I won't name him for his own confidentiality.
Yeah.
There's a deal we were working on. And there's a client that we knew and another bank we'd heard of that was trying to buy this deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the partner on my desk did, was he a partner? He was a managing director.
Yeah.
There was a managing director. He went out with the seller the night before.
Yeah.
And he got the seller pissed drunk.
Yeah.
He got the seller to agree to sell him $1 billion of this.
Yeah.
Even though the seller was supposed to be running an auction.
Yeah.
And so basically what he did was he front ran the auction.
Right, right.
Got the stocks.
Yeah.
Bought $1 billion of it the next day.
Yeah.
And then when the auction was running, people were bidding higher.
Yeah.
But they didn't know we were the ones who owned it.
Yeah.
They thought the seller still owned it.
Mm.
Right? And so that's just an example of like how cutthroat the environment is.
Yeah.
Where just one decision of I'm gonna take you out because I wanna take this business can change the dynamics of how much money you make.
Yeah.
Right.
That's incredible.
I mean, people would do anything for information, right?
Yeah.
Because it's a business of information.
Yeah.
Right. And so, I mean, you were out. I remember my boss used to tell me when you're out with clients, right, you're out till whatever time the client tells you you need to be out.
Yeah.
Right. There was times where I'll be out. I have work that I need to do.
Yeah.
Because the client wants to be out to 3 a.m. I'm out to 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Right. Because you never know. Within that, those wee hours,
what
information
gonna
he's going to share.
Yeah.
And that information can be extremely valuable in how you make decisions.
Yeah.
Right? There might be insight that you're going to get from that.
Yeah. Sounds really exciting, though.
So it is a business of information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds very exciting.
No, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun. What I'd say that it does do for you, which was interesting when I left that environment and I moved to Kenya,
mm-hmm.
is it does warp your view
mm-hmm.
of money in the world,
mm-hmm.
right? And I've told this story before because I had a great time. So this is not by any means saying that I didn't have a good time.
Yeah.
We used to play a game on the desk where every Friday,
mm-hmm.
from the partners all the way down to the associates, mm-hmm. everybody would put money in a pot.
How much
and we
money?
We used to call it weekend money.
Yeah.
Up to $15,000.
$15,000.
And you were given that money to spend on the weekend.
So, so is each individual giving up to $15,000 or the
pot is up to
$15,000?
The pot is up to $15,000.
Okay.
And yeah. you were given, that was called weekend money.
Yeah.
And so you were given that $15,000, but the ask was that you had to come back with an epic story. So you either went to Miami.
This is like Hangover.
Yeah, you either went to Miami, you did some wild, and you had to have pictures. There needs to be evidence that you were successful in making an epic story.
And like it's an epic story.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then the partners would vicariously live through us.
Yeah.
Because they'd be like,
of course,
of course they're married. I can't be out here in these streets. And to your point about money, I think a lot of them wanted to do it, but they were like, if I get divorced, it's just taking half. Like, I'm worth $100 million.
Yeah, I'm not...
Imagine being a partner worth $100 million. Like, you're not about to play.
Yeah. So they just contribute the money and then just, like, see what happens.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
What's
exactly.
the most epic story you had from an experience like that?
This guy's trying to put me on ice.
No one's gonna know who it is.
I would say one of the most epic stories, and I'll give a sanitized version of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
Was one Friday we left to Miami with a client.
Yeah.
And I won't name the client because he's a billionaire U.S. client.
Yeah.
And he took us on his jet, and I remember we were at dinner with him. He decided, hey, let's go to Miami.
Yeah.
And so we were like, all right, like, do we book flights? Like, what do we do? He's like, no. I'll call the jet.
Yeah.
So we get on a jet. We fly to Miami. We land in Miami Friday night. Right. I kid you not. We go to his penthouse in Miami.
Yeah.
There's just like clothes lined up in the penthouse. And he's like, pick whatever you want. Right. And this is like Gucci, Louis Vuitton, whatever. You dress up. And he's like, let's go out. And there's a club, for people who know Miami, there's a club in Miami called 11. Mm-hmm. And 11 doesn't close. Mm-hmm. It's 24/7, mm-hmm. literally. And when you get into the club, the way that the club is set up is there's no windows.
Yeah.
So you have no idea what time of day it is.
Yeah.
We got in, I think, around midnight on Friday night. Mm-hmm. We left at midday on Sunday.
Midday on Sunday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's and like... I think we... probably
a day and a half.
Yeah. We don't know the exact numbers, and we try to calculate. We don't know the exact numbers.
Yeah.
And we didn't want to ask the guy for his credit card. So we were like, but we estimated that we probably spent probably north of $100,000.
Yeah. In those 36 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was epic.
Yeah.
That was epic.
And then you leave the club, you fly back.
Yeah.
Sleep. Shower, go to work the next
day. No, I flew back and I slept. I slept. And then I went to work at midnight. Wow. Sunday night.
Okay.
To recover for all the work that I needed to do.
Yeah. That is crazy. Okay. So what actually makes you leave Goldman Sachs? And at this point, I assume now that you've saved, like you're investing, like you said, you had a stock portfolio. Mm-hmm. Like you're doing all these financially literate things, right? Yeah. So what makes you then leave?
So what made me leave was from college, I always knew I wanted to come back to the continent. Mm-hmm. I initially thought I wanted to come back as an investor. Mm-hmm. And I remember in 2017, I started meeting private equity, mostly private equity. I didn't know as many VCs. Mm-hmm. But what stood out for me in being an investor in the US market was in the US market, you had... even though you were a financial investor, mm-hmm. you always partnered with operators, right, to ensure that you could validate your business case, right? And you were just not investing as a spreadsheet investor, as we call it, right? I remember when I was meeting a lot of these private equity investors, and no knock on them, but to be honest, a lot of them were spreadsheet investors. Mm-hmm. Like, and I kept asking, like, okay, who on your team has the business knowledge? Yeah. And the people they would point me to are people who've built businesses in Europe, in other places, mm-hmm. but I'm like, these people have no Africa experience.
Yeah.
Right. So how do we know that they know how to build businesses in Africa?
Yeah.
And so I told myself, I said, look, if I want to be a good investor in Africa, mm-hmm. I need to learn how to actually build a business in Africa.
Yeah.
Right. And so at that time, I felt very strongly in my spirit that I needed to move. Mm-hmm. And when I realized like I didn't want to move straight into investing, mm-hmm. I started looking at how do I become an operator. Mm-hmm. And this is where serendipity comes in. And I use serendipity to basically talk about you know, God's will.
Right.
And what's funny is that in 2014, I had gone to visit my cousin in London because mm-hmm. my cousin was going to school in London. And I had gone to an event in London hosted by a guy named Charles Sakewaller. Mm-hmm. And Charles is the founder of Move Me Back. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the first people to join the platform. Mm-hmm. And I created a profile, forgot about it. Mm-hmm. And then sort of end of 2017, mm-hmm. I get a message from Move Me Back on mm-hmm. email mm-hmm. being like, Jumia is interested in you coming to work for Jumia. And I was like, who's Jumia? Mm. So I go Google, try and figure out like who's Jumia. And I'm like, oh, these guys are the Amazon of Africa. This is interesting.
Yeah.
So I take the call and she's still a good friend of mine, Diana Owusu, who is CCO of Jumia Kenya, interviewed me.
Yeah.
And they basically offered for me to come set up Jumia Global. Mm-hmm. So for those who've bought on Jumia, anything that says shipped from overseas, mm-hmm. that's Jumia Global.
Okay.
So I was responsible for setting that business up.
Okay.
And so that was one of my responsibilities, but I was also helping out with some of the local categories like computing.
Right.
Right. And so what made me leave was one, me wanting to exit and move back to the continent.
Yeah.
And knowing that Goldman wouldn't be able to offer that opportunity to me. Because mm-hmm. I'd actually explored that. I'd actually had many conversations with many partners mm-hmm. about, can I move to the Goldman South Africa office? Mm-hmm. And what everybody kept telling me is like, you're doing so well, that would be a demotion. Mm-hmm. Like you leaving New York to go to South Africa would move you backwards in terms of your progression at Goldman. Yeah. And so what they advised me was like, it's better you go out the firm to scratch this itch.
Yeah.
And then if you're not interested in doing it anymore, we'll hold a seat for you to come back. And that's one of the best things that I appreciate about Goldman and my mentors at Goldman was they left the door open for me.
Yeah.
So they told me like, look, if all else fails, you can come back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember when Jumia gave me the offer, I remember sitting down with my boss at the time and telling him I'm moving to Kenya.
Yeah.
And he was like, you're moving to where?
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm moving to Africa. He's like, take 2 weeks off.
Yeah. Let's start there. Yeah.
That was his reaction. He was like, I think you might be sleep deprived.
Yeah.
Burnout. Like,
something's happening.
Take 2 weeks off.
Yeah.
Like, sleep on this idea. And I took the 2 weeks off. I rested. And I came back and I was like, I still want to move.
Yeah.
And I think I appreciate his graciousness in being like, I'm going to take out the fear of, like, not having money from you.
Yeah.
Because I was taking a massive salary cut, right?
What's the cut that you're taking? And how much of a pay cut are you taking?
I went from earning close to $200,000 mm-hmm. to earning $50,000 at Jumia.
A year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a steep cut. That's a steep cut.
Yeah.
But I did that because for me, I was looking to the future.
Yeah.
And I saw Jumia as a place where I could learn.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I find that a lot of people lose sight of when they get into jobs is like we've lost the energy to learn.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people get into jobs and all they're focused on is like, how am I going to make money now?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And I feel like people need to get back to playing the long game.
Yeah.
Right. For me, Jumia was part of playing the long game. So that was why I was willing to take that salary cut.
Yeah.
Because for me, there was skills that I was getting from Jumia.
Yeah.
Right. There was absolutely no reason based on my CV that Jumia should have hired me and given me the position.
Yeah, I was also going to ask that as well.
Like, because I had no logistics experience.
Yeah, yeah.
I have no e-commerce experience.
Yeah.
Like, the only thing was I had Goldman Sachs and I'd done investing.
Yeah.
And I'd been successful doing investing.
Yeah.
But that doesn't always translate
to being able to be a successful business.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And so I think part of what I encourage people to do is
when
someone takes a chance on you,
focus
on the learning versus focusing on how am I monetizing today.
Yeah.
Right? Investing and finance is a long game.
Yeah.
Right? If you want to be able to monetize, you have to play the long game.
Yeah.
And it's about building the right skill set, right, in order to be able to get there.
Right.
When I was in college, I was building the right skill set for investing, which enabled me to be successful at Goldman.
Yeah.
I didn't know when I started the hedge fund that I was going to work for Goldman.
Yeah.
Right? But like I was investing in that skill set because I knew that the skill set was valuable.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so the same thing with Jumia. I was investing in the skill set of being an operator because I knew that it was going to help me be a better investor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense for sure. Okay. So you come back, take your pay cut. What's that? Because there's a shock of the pay cut, yes.
Oh, for sure.
But then now there's the practicality of it, of the way that you live, the way that you're saving or what you're putting aside. What's that? Is that a challenge for you or how do you go about that?
I think two things. I think one, what was good was that Nairobi is not as expensive. So with the 50,000, you could still live a decent life in Nairobi.
Yeah.
I think where I felt the shock a lot more, and I think it took me a few years to really kind of come to terms with it,
yeah,
is when I go back to New York.
Mm.
And that's where I think I really kind of fell off my financial discipline.
Yeah.
Because I was still trying to live the same lifestyle
that, you used to live
that I used to live in New York.
Right.
But I wasn't earning the same money.
Yeah.
And that's where I really started finding myself starting to get in debt.
Yeah.
Right. And really starting to build credit card debt.
Yeah.
Right. Because I would go to New York and my friends were used to me spending, right, like the way I used to spend in New York.
Yeah.
Right. Because I'm still very close to a lot of my childhood friends.
Yeah.
So I used to always invite them to New York. And, you know, of course, not everybody's made it to the same level.
Right.
Right. And so what I would do so that my friends don't feel out of place
is
I would always tell them, like, bro, if I invite you.
Yeah.
You don't worry.
Yeah.
I got it.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that habit had built. Mm. So when I would come back and I would invite them to New York, they would come with the same expectation.
Yeah.
Like, yo, he's about to ball out.
Yeah.
And like, I didn't have the same money to ball out.
Yeah.
And so this is where ego comes in, right? Yeah. This is the thing.
You never had the conversation with them to be like,
you don't. You're like, nah, I got it. Like, I'm good. I'll figure this out.
Yeah.
And then like, you start realizing like 2 years later, like, yo, this credit card bill is getting quite big.
Yeah.
Like, how am I going to pay this?
Yeah.
And so I think there were a lot of bad decisions
because
I had not made a lifestyle adjustment in New York to match, you know, the change in salary.
Yeah.
I think in Nairobi, I had done it.
You were fine. Yeah.
I was fine.
Yeah.
But I think the problem is I used to go home every year in December.
So every year you'd come back with a...
Exactly.
A bill.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then I'll tell myself, I'll work myself out of this bill.
Yeah.
Throughout the year. But what I was always doing, which was like, which is a kind of good habit, was I would always put a little bit of money aside to invest.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem, which comes back to the arrogance,
mm-hmm.
was I would invest that money, but not necessarily use it to pay back my debt.
Because
I would say I'm earning more than in terms of returns in my investments versus my debt. So I would pay the minimum on the debt.
Yeah.
Right.
So how big did your debt get to?
Ooh.
Assuming that now you've gotten hold of it.
That debt got big. That got to like $30,000.
Yeah. And how long did that take to pay off?
We're still paying it off.
Even now?
Even now.
Jesus.
Still bearing the
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is, look, I paid off all the high interest ones.
Right.
Right now where I am, I have a lot of low interest. So less than 3%.
Yeah.
So my portfolio, even my fixed income portfolio, does better than my debt.
Yeah.
So you're always covering it.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. But that is a lesson in life.
Yeah.
In terms of when you change your earnings.
Yeah.
Are you adjusting your lifestyle accordingly?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Or are you trying to maintain the same lifestyle even though your reality has changed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about how Backy Beauty even comes to be. Yeah. Because you said you were in the pharmaceutical space and you wanted to do something and you couldn't really quite change it while you were at
Good Life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, yeah, your wife's like, yeah, just do this thing on your own.
Mm.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about that.
So let me take you back a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a bit of a longer story that leads into it. So I'll take you back to when I was at Soko Watch.
Mm-hmm.
So Soko Watch was founded by one of my best friends from college, Daniel Yu.
Mm-hmm.
He started it when we were in college together.
Mm-hmm.
I joined him as a founding team member,
mm-hmm.
and I was the number two, right? And when I joined him, I remember when I was leaving Jumia, right? They at the time had just raised their seed round. They'd raised about $3 million in seed funding, and the business was doing about $3 million in revenue,
mm-hmm.
right? And the business was in Nairobi. No one thought it was going to go anywhere,
yeah.
right? And at the time, this was like 2019,
mm-hmm.
Jumia was just IPOing.
Yeah.
So imagine leaving a business that just IPO'd
yeah.
and going to a very early stage startup
right.
that has no success,
yeah.
right? And when I got there, the vision of what we always wanted to do with Soko Watch was we wanted to be a platform
mm-hmm.
that enabled distribution across multiple categories.
Mm-hmm.
And one category that we were especially keen on was healthcare,
mm-hmm.
right? So Daniel comes from a family of doctors. You know, my whole life, my mom has been sick most of my life,
mm-hmm.
right? And I always say that we're fortunate that because of my dad's work, particularly with the African Development Bank, we've had access to really high quality health insurance,
yeah.
that the problems of the African health ecosystem has not negatively impacted our family.
Right.
But one thing I used to always say, and COVID really put this front and center for me, was if we have a health crisis,
mm-hmm.
this healthcare system ain't gonna work for us.
Yeah.
Right. And the fact that many of us more well-off Africans depend on flying abroad,
yeah,
right? COVID was a reality where now you couldn't fly abroad.
Yeah.
Now you were left to have to deal with the local healthcare ecosystem that we have.
Yeah.
Right? And so when COVID hit and I was at Wasoko, the question I started asking myself was, how do we use the platform that we've built to be able to now start to change the healthcare industry? But the problem was the sector we were in became en vogue, right? So you had Market Force, you had Twiga, who were raising large amount of money to compete with us.
Yeah.
Right. And so what we said was, you know, we didn't want to distract ourselves by looking at new categories when we hadn't really solidified our place as the number one in the category that we were in.
Yeah.
Right. And so what I started doing was I started angel investing. Right. So this is when I pulled my head up in sort of end of 2020, 2021.
Yeah.
And I started investing in healthcare startups. So that's where it began. I started looking at healthcare startups. And one of the.
And how much are you putting in at the time?
I'm putting in $5,000-$10,000.
Okay.
And then one of the startups that I got introduced to and invested in was Uncover. And Uncover was really what opened my eyes to the gap that existed in Black skincare.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, coming from the US, right, I always kind of assume that, oh, because we're in Africa, most of the products are made for Black people.
Yeah.
Right. And so I find Uncover, I do research on their story that they're telling me, and I'm like, okay, wow, like there is a massive gap in this market.
Yeah.
And then at the time, Good Life asked me to start advising for them because they were trying to go digital in 2021.
Right.
Right. And I knew one of the partners on the Good Life board because it's owned by a private equity company. So I get on the board, I start advising them, and I realize there's a huge opportunity in pharmacy because in my mind, I just always assumed Good Life already did beauty.
Yeah.
Right. But when I got there and I started looking at the numbers, I realized beauty was very small for them relative to, say, Clicks in South Africa, Boots in the UK, where a lot of these pharmacy businesses have moved to beauty because the beauty journey looks very similar to the pharmacy journey.
Yeah.
Right. Most consumers... most of us don't really know what's the best product for ourselves, right?
Yeah.
We're guessing.
Yeah.
We're depending on influencers. Yeah. We're, oh, my mom used to use this, my friend used this, and so I think it'll work for me.
Yeah.
But the truth is, all of us are unique, right? And the same way, just because you have pain, you wouldn't just use the same pain medication I'm using. You ask a pharmacist, hey, what's best for me?
Yeah.
The same is true in beauty,
right?
But no one had designed the beauty journey in that way.
Yeah.
So when I got to Good Life, I had these ideas in my mind about how do we design a beauty journey that resembles the pharmacy journey that is built around experts, right? Unfortunately, because of, you know, this where investment interests, right, collide, that was not a core focus for them.
Yeah.
Right. And I respect it. Right. There is a massive space that is needed in terms of being able to help diabetics, being able to help people who are hypertensive and the rest.
Right.
And so I felt that this needed to be built.
Yeah.
Right. You needed a platform that was enabling access to quality beauty experts.
Yeah.
For both skin, hair and scalp. You needed access to quality products that were made for Black skin and Black hair.
Yeah.
Right. And no one was doing it.
Yeah.
Right. And so... that was the genesis of Baki, right?
Yeah.
And so the reason why I felt that we needed to start a bit earlier was the story built, right? And a lot of my investors in Baki are actually investors from Wasoko, right? Like my best friend Daniel is one of our biggest investors, who's the CEO of Wasoko.
Yeah.
He's invested in Baki,
right?
One of our early investors, which is a family office in Wasoko, is also one of my biggest investors in Baki.
Yeah.
And so... It's funny because like the story continues to build, right?
Yeah.
So it was like we built Wasoko, we took it from 3 million to over 300 million in top line.
Yeah.
Right? Over 3 years.
Yeah.
So that's 100x revenue growth in 3 years.
Right.
Right. And we raised, I think this is what Franklin was talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
We raised from when I joined to when I left, almost $140 million. Right. And so we raised a sizable amount of money.
Yeah.
Right. But all of that foundation was setting me up for what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you think about what we're doing with Baki, we're basically enabling what I call the infrastructure layer of the beauty industry.
Right.
We're enabling high quality Black beauty brands. And I use that term very loosely because you can be building a Black beauty brand even if you're L'Oreal.
Yeah.
Right, you don't have to be exclusively building for Black people.
Yeah.
Right, and I think it's important to make that distinction.
Yeah.
And so we're building a platform where guys like L'Oreal or guys like Uncover can actually come and position their products to the right audience.
Yeah.
Right, and that's distribution B2C But to be successful in Africa,
yeah.
which is the foundation of Wasoko, is you have to build distribution, both D2C and B2B. As well as B2B.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's what we're doing.
Yeah,
so we see ourselves as a distribution platform
yeah.
that is both enabling online as well as offline distribution.
Okay.
Right? But we're doing it right now exclusively in beauty.
Yeah.
We do see the company evolving into the wellness space.
Yeah.
Because we do think beauty is foundational to thinking about wellness more holistically.
Right.
Right? Because, I mean, if you think about human nature, right? We are very driven by more immediate results.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Why do many people fall off their gym routines? Yeah. Right? It takes time.
Yeah. yeah.
Right?
But we want to see it right now.
Exactly. Yeah, but yeah. one of the good things with not all beauty routines, but yeah. most,
is you will can see results quite soon. Yeah.
Quite soon.
Yeah. yeah
and so that true. Encourages someone.
Yeah.
And so if you start there, you can now start to encourage them that, hey, to also maintain your skin results, yeah. go to the gym.
Yeah.
If you want to maintain your skin results, eat right.
Right.
So that's right. where we're trying to go.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. And I mean, I think there's definitely like a succinct story as to why and a vision and a mission and something that you're really trying to achieve. I want to ask you a question around raising money and raising capital from two perspectives. One, because it seems like you have experience now in like, you know, building businesses in Kenya and in an African context. What's happening or what has happened mm-hmm. with a bunch of the startups that mm-hmm. have been able to raise X million dollars, you know, and at some point they seem like, yeah, everything is going right. Then at some point,
everything
just goes left. And then it's like, yeah, so whoever and whoever are not here anymore and we are closing yeah. operations in Kenya. And you're like, what happened? You just raised the money a couple of months ago.
Mm. Yeah. So as someone who also angel invests in a number of startups and, you know, been privy to seeing, you know, some of the inside information on some of these stories.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it comes back to what I call drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Right. So what do I mean by that? When you're fundraising, and I think this is the difficulty of being able to hold tension of two things. Yeah. Right. When you're fundraising, you have to tell the story of what is to come.
Yeah.
Right? And you have to tell it in such a way that you believe it.
Yeah.
Right? Because otherwise people are going to suss you out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have to recognize the reality of where you are.
Yeah.
And it is a journey to get from where you are to where you want to go.
Yeah.
But I think what I see a lot of founders do is they make the mistake of believing they're already there.
Yeah.
And that the money is a validation that I've made it.
Yeah.
The money's not a validation that you've made it. The money is fuel.
Yeah.
Right? And so when you raise that fuel, now is when the hard work begins, right? And so I think part of the problem that I've seen is a lot of founders raise the money and they see the money as a validation and the destination versus the money being an enabler to get to the destination.
Right.
And the destination has to be profitability.
Yeah.
Right? The destination can't be, I'm going to raise my next round.
Yeah.
Right? And I think it's a very different mindset. I think when I got into the startup industry, coming from distressed investing, coming from being a credit investor and a private equity investor, mm-hmm. I think I was very taken aback by like the fact that people were very happy to continually be loss-making businesses
yeah.
and raising money. I'm like,
yeah.
why would you want to keep raising money?
Yeah.
like
that's not the point.
No, like you spend your whole life selling, right? Yeah. Raising money is basically like you're a professional beggar,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
For lack of a better word.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And so for me, I'm like, why not be in control of your own destiny?
Yeah.
Because the more you have to raise, the more of your company you have to give away.
Yeah.
The more control you're giving away,
yeah.
the more voices you have around the table,
yeah. Yeah.
the more opinions about where the business should go.
Yeah.
And when you have too many cooks in the kitchen, right, things go wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big part about it.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part about it. And I remember I was at an event a few weeks ago that I was speaking at called Faith-Driven Investors.
Mm-hmm.
And they had invited a bunch of US investors mm-hmm. To come to Kenya to get a better understanding of investing in the Kenyan ecosystem. And one of the questions they were asking me was around this, right? Like, where do I see both investors and people going wrong? And I was saying that a lot of it comes back to setting clear expectations,
mm-hmm.
right? I think one thing that I've also seen is many investors don't hold space
mm-hmm.
for founders to come with real problems.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the truth is about business is not just linear. Right.
Yeah.
Most of us tell the story of like, here's where we started.
Yeah,
and here's where we are.
Yeah.
But the truth is like you take the Wasoko journey.
Yeah.
They were I'll tell. And I think it's important to be real.
Yeah.
I'll tell the story of our Series A.
Yeah.
We were less than 3 months of running out of money.
Like completely.
Completely.
Yeah.
We couldn't pay suppliers. We were begging suppliers
yeah.
to not cut us off.
Yeah.
right? And I remember our Series A kept getting delayed.
Yeah.
And in Feb of 2020, we were in Kigali to hold our board meeting.
Yeah.
And our lead investor for our Series A had actually flown into Kigali, and she wanted to join the board meeting.
Yeah.
And we were sitting in her hotel lobby,
yeah.
and we told her, you can't join the board meeting until you sign. Right? Yeah. And she signed, and she wired with less than a month of money left.
Yeah.
Right?
Like you were at the brink of,
yeah.
like, we're done.
But no one talks about that.
Yeah.
Right? No one talks about, like, we were, many times we almost failed.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think being able to have those real conversations with your investors,
yeah.
and being like, hey, here's the reality.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, a lot of founders don't feel like they have that space.
Yeah.
And so part of what also then happens is when they're in trouble, they don't go to the right people for help.
Yeah.
And so by the time they're having to go to those people,
yeah.
right, what you find is that it's already too late.
Yeah.
Like, the train has already left.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you can't fix what is already gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I'd say those are the two problems. One yeah. is drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Two is not having people that's who you can be honest with.
Yeah.
And be like, yo, here's the reality of where my business is.
Yeah.
I need help.
Okay.
Right? And I think that's that is in one part the investors holding space.
Yeah.
But in another part, it's a responsibility in us as founders to have the humility to say, hey, I yeah. have a problem.
Okay.
Right.
I have two final questions because I'm sure I'm going to have you back. Shiko, we need to have him back so we can finish this discussion. But my first question is, okay, so you've talked about, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid and having that space. Mm. So what is it that you've done with Baki Beauty that's mm. allowed you to not fall into, or that's currently, I'm assuming, allowing you not to fall into that trap and that, yeah, you know, 6-7 months from now, we won't be like, yeah, they were a thing. And then, you know, it's like, I'm even forgetting names. There have been so many businesses that have come and gone in the last couple of years. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, it is a work in progress, right? Yeah. Baki's only 7 months old.
Yeah.
So have we completely de-risked the story? I would
yeah.
say no.
Yeah.
We're still in the process of de-risking the story. But I think one thing that we've done is I interview our investors as much as they interview us.
Mm.
Right? And I'm very clear with them and very candid with them about what is the opportunity before us
yeah.
and how do we plan to capture that opportunity?
Yeah.
And so what happens is some of them are going to opt out.
Yeah.
And that's okay, right? That's okay that someone thinks, actually, this is not the business for me.
Yeah.
And just being okay with the fact that, like, some people are just not going to back your business. That's one. I think two, not over-raising.
Yeah.
Right? I remember when we were starting, there were a number of investors who were offering us more than we needed.
Yeah.
And I remember being tempted to
just take the money.
Just take the money, right? Because yeah. that was the advice I was getting. Everyone yeah. was like, yo, in this investment climate, if you have money on the table,
take it. Yeah.
And I kept, like, my gut kept telling me that if you take this money, the strings that come with this money
yeah.
will be more than you can bear.
Yeah.
And so I decided to take a third of what I was being offered.
Mm.
But I did it in such a way that it came predominantly from friends and family.
Mm.
So that gives us a lot more flexibility to build the right foundation in the building, in the business. And one of the things that I tell the team all the time is that our growth and the growth that we're focusing on is not because we want to grow quickly for investors,
yeah.
but it's because we want to grow quickly to maintain our own independence.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the faster we get to profitability,
yeah.
the more independent we can be.
Yeah.
Because now we can be a decider of our own decisions.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think one, the type of investors you bring in.
Yeah.
I think two, thinking about how are you designing out your growth.
Yeah.
So are you growing to grow sustainably?
Yeah.
Right? Meaning profitability.
Yeah.
Or are you growing because you're looking for your next round?
Yeah.
Right?
Mm.
And then not taking more than you need.
Yeah.
Right? I think the temptation to take more than you need
is always there.
Okay. Especially when you're starting.
Yeah.
Right? And when you're starting and the idea is not fully baked,
yeah.
you need time to figure out, like, what direction are we actually going to go?
Yeah.
Right? How Baki looks today versus where we were 7-8 months ago
yeah.
is very, very different.
Yeah.
Right? In terms of where we thought. Like, I'll give you a good example.
Yeah.
When we started, we thought we're only going to focus on Black women.
Yeah.
Right? Today, I think men make up about 30% of our sales.
Mm.
And men are our fastest growing category.
Yeah.
Right? Who would have known?
Yeah.
Like, in a beauty business that men would be so active.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think that is a big learning, and we were open to that.
Yeah.
And so I'd say, especially in the early days, you have to be open to what I call market feedback.
Yeah.
So that you can pivot. But if you take money from investors who expect a certain thing,
yeah,
there's not, you there's lose no, that flexibility.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because yeah. then you're worried about, oh, did I lie?
Yeah.
Right? Because now you're about to come back and say, okay, so I started this business for black women.
But now
I'm focusing on men.
Yeah.
Now you feel like you're being disingenuous.
Yeah.
Right? But when you raise money from people who are like, I'm just giving money for you, you figure out what you want this thing to look like.
Yeah.
Then you have that flexibility to be like, okay, let me form this thing as to what it needs to look like.
Okay. Final question. Where do people find people like you? And what I mean by that is, you talk about angel investing and then, giving $5,000-$10,000. Like in the Nairobi network or in the Kenyan context or even African context, like where, because I feel like you guys are like a community, like this, it's almost like a sorority, like a secret community where I only hear of you guys amongst certain rooms. So like, I know you, I know Franklin, I know another guy called Martin Ruga. Mm-hmm. But it's like you guys exist in like a secret community, you know, and you speak about it like you're everywhere. It's like, yeah, just find an angel investor for your business. And I was like,
I don't know
if that's easy. Yeah,
I know what you mean. So where do you find angels like myself?
Yeah.
Shout out to Naiban. Mm-hmm. That's Naiban.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm one of the founding members of that. It's an angel network.
Mm-hmm.
They have today over 100 angels,
mm-hmm.
both local Kenyan angels as well as Africans and non-Africans,
right,
who invest. And Naiban can write anywhere from 5,000 to 50,000.
Yeah.
Sometimes even up to 100,000. So I'd say Google Naiban, go on LinkedIn, message Naiban. They're always open to listening to pitches.
Yeah.
Both for tech businesses as well as non-tech businesses.
Right.
Like Uncover is a business I brought to Naiban. Mm. Uncover is not a tech business.
Yeah.
So Naiban is one. I would say I'm actually speaking on Friday at Local Capital.
Mm-hmm.
So they have an event about growth, and Local focuses on creating a forum for local angels,
mm-hmm.
so predominantly just Africans,
yeah,
right, and predominantly Kenyans to be able to invest in Kenyan startups.
Yeah.
And so Local Capital is another one that I would shout out that I think is doing a great job really kind of bringing and trying to bridge that gap,
yeah,
right, between founders and local investors who want to invest in these companies.
Mm-hmm.
I think particularly for when it comes to women networks, Kayana,
mm-hmm.
That's Pat Okello's business. Kayana is another one that I recommend, particularly for female founders.
Yeah.
I think Kayana has a great program. Let me think. I think accelerators.
Yeah.
Right? Apply to the accelerators.
Yeah.
I think if you are new to the startup industry, you need a lot of training.
Yeah.
There's a language to fundraising that you need to learn to speak.
Yeah.
Right? And I think a lot of people think just because I have a good business means that I can raise.
Yeah.
No. You have to speak the language of raising.
Yeah.
I've seen people raise who have a poor business.
Yeah.
But because they speak the language of raising,
able to
right?
Be, yeah.
And so I think get yourself in the accelerator.
Yeah.
Right? And go through that curriculum.
Yeah.
And like, it might be painful and you might be upset that you're giving up 10% of your business for $100,000.
Yeah.
But that $100,000, back to what I was talking about in terms of being long-term greedy.
Yeah.
Right? You, by being long-term greedy, you recognize that, sure, the accelerator seems like they're taking a lot, but they're giving me skills that will pay me value over a long period of time.
Yeah.
And so Antler is a good one. Baobab Network is a good one. I'll think of others and I'll share.
Okay.
All right, cool. But I would say those are how I would recommend
how
you get in touch with folks like myself.
Okay.
Yeah, those are the main ways.
So if it gives us any others, we'll put them in the description box for guys to have a look at. Okay, all right. Final thing, where is all your money right now? I was going to ask you two questions, either what you're worth or where your money is.
Wow, what I'm worth. I don't know if I'll disclose what I'm worth. I don't know if I'll disclose what I'm worth. People can guess. Yeah. We'll leave you all to guess.
Yeah.
Where is I would say majority. I have a lot of money tied up in Wasoko. Let me say that.
Yeah.
The success of Wasoko is critical to my net worth.
Okay.
And then that's my number one holding.
Uh-huh.
My number two holding is of course Baki.
Yeah.
Right. So I'd say Baki is now my number two holding. My number three used to be Tesla.
Yeah.
I used to own a lot of Tesla shares.
Okay.
But with the run up in Tesla, I've sold a lot. I think I sold over 50% of our position. And then NVIDIA. I got into NVIDIA in 2021, right? And I got into NVIDIA, funny enough, not because I knew anything about AI blowing up the way it did. I got into NVIDIA because I've been a keen investor in the gaming space. So I started with Activision, and NVIDIA makes a lot of the gaming chips.
Yeah.
And I saw a trend that was happening in gaming, especially with the shift to programs like Fortnite. And if you look at the graphics of like programs like Fortnite, where during COVID, the Travis Scott actually did a concert in the game. To be able to power that, right, from a technological perspective, you need like crazy advanced chips. And so I realized that the only people who could design and build these chips at scale was NVIDIA. So that was my whole thesis. But then I've ridden the whole the AI wave. So like I feel like NVIDIA has actually done better than a lot of my startup investments in Africa. NVIDIA has been like what, a 15x return. Right? In from 2021 till date. So I'd say that's the bulk of my my holdings. But and I we have a few African startups that we invested in as well.
And final question: did all the money that you've sort of invested, whether it's angel investing or buying, you know, equity in any of these places, all that money was from the money you made at Goldman Sachs, or majority of it from the money you made at Goldman Sachs?
So recycling back the winnings. Recycling back the winnings.
We'll have you again to finish. I feel like there's lots of stuff we can talk about.
I'd love to be back.
I hope you enjoyed it,
No, this is amazing.
It was good, no?
This is good.
Yeah, you should get into podcasts. He's been scripted to get into podcasts. We'll see if he does. All right, guys. Thank you so much for this episode. We will see you guys on the next episode. This was Financially Incorrect, and this was a lot of fun.
Amazing. All right. Thank you.